This is XTP Media.
You're listening to Extended. Your hosts, Peter Johnson from XTP Media, Gareth Stringer from Global Aviation Resource, and Tim Robinson from the Royal Aeronautical Society.
Hello there, I'm Peter Johnson, and welcome to this extra episode, episode 53 of Aerospace Radio Station Extended. Today I'm flying solo as Tim travels back from the Singapore Air Show and poor old Gareth is recovering from a virus. Now, a short while ago, we were invited by the Royal Navy 848 Squadron to attend a retirement event for the Sea King Mark IV. On the 31st of March this year, it will be finally retired from the Helicopter Commando Force and it's being replaced by the Merlin Mark III. We thought it would be a good feature to take you along with us through the briefings and eventually on board Sea King Avenger 2. I also had the chance to grab a few minutes with David Berings, who's an extremely honoured engineer who worked on the Sea King for Westland in the early years. Also in this episode, we take a further look at the Barracuda Restoration Project with Dave Morris, the curator at the Fleet Air Arm Museum. We also have a discussion with naval air historian Matt Willis on the role of the Barracuda and his new book on the Shark, as well as getting his views on the retirement of the Sea King. But before we get to that, we just wanted to take a few moments to reflect on the very sad passing of Captain Eric Winkle Brown. Long associated with the Fly Navy Heritage Trust, the following statement on Captain Brown's career was released on their website. Born in 1919 at Leith near Edinburgh, Winkle joined the Fleet Air Arm in 1939 as a fighter pilot, flying martlets from the aircraft carrier HMS Audacity. He developed revolutionary combat tactics against the heavily armed Fokker Wolf Condor and survived the sinking of HMS Audacity when she was hit by torpedoes from a German U-boat. At the end of the war, he was chief pilot on the joint UK-US mission to retrieve Germany's most closely guarded technological secrets, flying many German aircraft and helping to liberate Belsen concentration camp. After the war, his career as a naval test pilot spanned three decades during the most exciting and innovative period in aviation history. An aviation scientist at heart, Winkle relished the birth of the jet age and the radical new designs it spawned. The new science of aerodynamics and advances in jet engine technology saw the top speed of military fighters rise from a sedate 600 miles an hour to a blistering 1400 miles an hour within a few years. He set four Guinness World Records for the greatest number of aircraft types flown, 487, the most individual carrier deck landings, 2,407, and he was the first to land both a twin-engined and jet aircraft on an aircraft carrier, records which will almost certainly now never be broken. Now, we did interview Captain Brown some time ago on Extended, and I thought it would be nice just to bring you a little bit of that interview that he had with Tim.
Captain Brown, what inspired you to fly in the first place?
Well, it almost was inevitable because my father had been a pilot in the Royal Flying Corps and after 1918 joined in the RAF. So, with that influence, how can you avoid it?
You've racked up a record-breaking number of aircraft types flown. Were you in an informal race with any other pilots at any point? Was anyone else trying to beat your record? Or
I tell you, I wasn't even aware that I was in this category, but somebody had looked at my logbooks. When I say somebody, another fellow pilot. And he alerted the Guinness Book of Records that it might be this way. Now, the Guinness Book of Records are very, very fussy about checking that the facts are right. And they took quite a few years to do this. And they contacted various countries and asked them if they could compete with this number, etc. So it was a question of build-up, mainly due to the fact that I was in the job here at Farnborough. And, of course, post-war, during the war to begin with, we were flooded with American types flying in. America gave us almost every type of aircraft they had so that we could at least find out how things were advancing. And then, after the war, there were all the German aircraft, there were all the Italian aircraft, there were all the Japanese aircraft. And when you get access to all these, they pile up.
What was the first and the last type in your logbook?
The first type that I personally flew would be the Miles Magister. The last one I flew, I think, was the Phantom 2.
Wow, okay. And your career has obviously spanned biplanes, jets, rocket-powered aircraft. Were you ever interested in flying the World War I types or the early kind of aircraft?
Well, during my career, I didn't have much chance to do this. Of course, afterwards, there was the Shuttleworth collection, and I was still flying there, and I was asked if I would like to join them, but the Navy would not agree to me doing this. I think possibly because they had things in mind for me, and secondly, they probably considered them a little dangerous.
What difference to being a Navy pilot to mean to your flying career? How did it sort of...
Well, of course, if you're a Navy pilot, you are involved mainly in, or a large part of your aviation life is involved with aircraft carrier landings. Now, aircraft carrier landings, after every flight, you have to get back to your ship. And it... I would say deck landing on an aircraft carrier has a certain affinity to Russian roulette. It is a difficult business. It has improved with time, but in the early days, or the quite early days, the war period certainly, it was a pretty hazardous affair.
What was your favourite type of test flying? Was there any particular phase or test that you
enjoyed? I think the bit I enjoyed most was flying the German aircraft after the war, because we were surprised how advanced they were. And it was an absolute revelation to us. And in fact, almost frighteningly revealing that when you think of what might have been.
What attributes make up a good sort of test pilot in terms of sort of temperament or skills? Or
well, it's interesting you ask that, because I did an interview with the BBC and my wife was involved, and she was asked if she had any worries about me test flying, and she said, "Oh no," she said, "he'd." Doesn't worry about himself because he's got no imagination. He can't see himself involved in making a big hole in the ground. So maybe that's the answer.
Captain Brown will sorely be missed. So, let's get started with the Sea King retirement. In service with the Royal Navy since the mid-60s, the Mark IV is easily identified by its lack of floats. Heavily modified from the original Sikorsky HC-3 Sea King, Westland in effect built a new aircraft, better suited to British military needs. In fact, the Mark IV was originally specified for Egyptian forces, but the Ministry of Defence soon saw the opportunity for its ageing Wessex fleets. The term jungly doesn't come from the Sea King, but from previous commando operations in places like Borneo, but it really fits the Sea King Mark IV. However, the Mark IV has a long list of its own service honours, and it has served in the Falklands, Iraq and Afghanistan, as well as across the world with the commandos from Norway to the Philippines. It's very well thought of by its crews and engineers, and it survived some really intense battle damage, bringing its crews and commandos home safely. I went along to HMS Heron, and we were first met and briefed by Lieutenant Aaron Cross.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to 848 Naval Air Squadron. My name's Aaron Cross. I'm the flight commander of a flight within 848 Naval Air Squadron. First of all, welcome, as I say, and thank you very much for coming. When we first talked about having a media event, I wasn't sure how many people we'd have turn up, but in the 5 years I've been here, I think I've only seen standing room only in this room once or twice, so it's great to have you all here, and I really hope we can give you the opportunity to get the photographs and the interviews that you require. I've just got a few slides, maybe 10 minutes or so. So those of you who are standing, I mean, you may want to sit down. There is some space. Before we move down to the hangar, which will be kind of the staging post for the rest of the day. Down there, we've got aircraft being worked on, so you'll be able to have a look around those. There's nothing classified out, so please do poke around. None of the engineering work that's going on is particularly urgent either. So the guys will be down there for you to speak to, and it'll be from there that we further brief you on the aircraft, take you out to the aircraft, and take you out to the aircraft that have been allocated for the static photography. By way of a welcome, I know this is a well-informed audience, so I won't go into too much detail, but I think a few of you perhaps are more concerned with military aviation rather than CHF or 848 or the Sea King in particular. So I'll just spend a couple of minutes talking about the squadron initially. So 848 Naval Air Squadron, one of four Commando Helicopter 4 squadrons. You can see our mission statement: provide tactical mobility. What's that? Mobility, fairly self-explanatory. You can imagine if you were a Royal Marines company commander and you have your 100 or so Marines on the battlefield, well, if you give us a call, then we can move you around. And the tactical element just means we can do that without being shot down by the enemy. And that's really what we do in a nutshell. The squadron, of course, doesn't hasn't just operated the Sea King in its history. And you can see from our battle honours that we were operating fixed-wing aircraft in World War II and were all decorated appropriately. More recently, a few of our operations at the bottom. And really, when you're speaking to the guys, if they've served on the squadron for a couple of years or 5 or 10 years, then these operations are going to be where they draw most of their experience. As Tracy mentioned, there are a few of us who are a little bit older. I'll introduce them later, but they do have experience that goes back to operations in Northern Ireland, operations in Bosnia, and operations in the Gulf War. That's the squadron. The aircraft, the Sea King Mark IV, trooping is what we call that tactical mobility, and that just means getting blokes in the back of the aircraft and moving them around. The photo there is from the last media day. The other, that was a joke. The other aircraft, the other role that we can perform is, of course, load lifting. So that is when we hook underneath the aircraft, we've got a big meaty hook, and we can take Land Rovers, artillery pieces, a load of water, food, ammunition, whatever we need to, if it's in a net, and we can move that around the battlefield. So they're the kind of two roles that we operate, trooping and load lifting. The next point concerns how we get the soldiers out of the aircraft once they're inside, and other than just landing them on and them jumping out of the door, we do have three other methods that are a bit more specialist in terms of capability. The first is fast roping, which I'm sure most of you are familiar with. We drop a rope out of the side of the cargo door, and it's quite a thick rope, and it acts much like a fireman's pole. So the guys slide down that with thick gloves on. Second is abseiling, similar, but we can go up to about 200 feet compared to about 100 feet with fast roping, and of course parachuting right up to the top of the aircraft's service ceiling. The fourth point there really speaks of the inherent flexibility of helicopters. You know, we can do casualty evacuation or search and rescue or a myriad other roles that are classed as secondary roles by us, and the equipment we use very often in executing those roles is a hoist just above the cargo door, which you'll see later, and that's rated up to 600 pounds. So no man in theory should ever be too heavy for that, and that again is down to about 200 feet. So that's all I've got in terms of briefing on the squadron and the aircraft. I hope that was a good scene setter. Are there any questions at this point on anything I've covered so far to inform your articles? Great. Well, if there is at any point, then just let me know. Next, I'll cover the programme, what we're doing today. So, we're a bit early, which is only a good thing. On completion of this brief, we'll move down to the hangar, as I mentioned, and there we will cover the flying briefs in detail, so you'll get to climb into the aircraft and practice where you're going to sit, how you're going to strap in before you get airborne. Aircraft familiarisation, and you'll be able to meet the air crew and engineers, as I mentioned. The sortie was approved this morning by the commanding officer of the squadron, who, by the way, sends his apologies, he's tasking in another aircraft today. So, you'll be pleased to know that the standard level of flight planning in 848 Naval Squadron goes a bit beyond this. but for your awareness, you're going to depart out of Yeovilton and head out to the north to Glastonbury, so you'll see the sunset, the green rolling fields of Somerset, and maybe some flooding. I'm not sure I haven't met up that way in the last few days. We've chosen Glastonbury Tor because it's an instantly recognisable feature, so hopefully you'll be able to get that in shot. On the way up, the way it's going to work, there'll be two Sea Kings, excuse hands, but the cargo door on the Sea King, as you all know, is on the right-hand side, so it will only be the photographers in the left-hand Sea King who can actually take photos of the other Sea King. Everybody with me? So about halfway up to Glastonbury, you'll swap positions so the other aircraft can get the other aircraft in shot. So the sortie will be about 500 feet, which is which can seem quite low in the photos, and you'll be at about 90 knots on your way up and back. It's good weather, which we couldn't guarantee, but we've been lucky. Any questions on the flying?
After Lieutenant Cross, there was a chance for questions from the floor to Captain Niall Griffin, MBE, Commanding Officer of the Commando Helicopter Force, all about the jungly.
I suppose just what a momentous occasion, really, the end of the mighty Sea King Mark IV. I personally had the pleasure of flying the Sea King since 1990. It shows my age. There's some more in the background who've flown it for longer. I think everybody who has flown the Sea King would recognise what a forgiving aeroplane it is to fly, what an enjoyable aeroplane it is to fly, and how well it served us right across every operational sphere that Defence has been involved in for several decades, which is quite remarkable, really. So it is truly momentous that we have to say goodbye to the Sea King in a few weeks' time. I understand you're all going to get flying this afternoon, so you'll be able to go and experience it. That's fantastic. I hope you enjoy that. Look forward to seeing all your kind words about the Sea King and Aircraft Squadron in particular in due course. So, I mean, I'm open to any questions, really. That's all I'm going to say. In terms of format, how long you've got before everybody needs to get out of the hangar?
You've got 10 minutes, sir.
OK, so I'm just open for questions as to whatever people might want to ask. God, Patrick, you've got to lead off. No.
It's obviously, you know, a truly amazing helicopter and the service it's had. Could you try and summarise that? And, you know, I know you've only got 10 minutes, you've probably spent weeks talking about it, but try and summarise the service history of the Commando Sea King.
Crikey, I mean, all the way back from the Falklands through every single operational theatre that the UK's been to, really. And it has been pretty relentless. I think we added it up last year, 25 years, constantly on operations somewhere around the globe, which in itself is a probably unparalleled contribution to UK defence. And whether that's been from the pretty harsh war-fighting environment in Afghanistan or Iraq over the last decade or so, back to the days of Northern Ireland and Bosnia, back to the Falklands, clearly, where it was a real stalwart at its embryonic stages. the introduction of night vision goggle flying, and it was a forerunner to that. It's been just a forerunner for all sorts of things. But equally, going on to the peace support and humanitarian aid as recently as Operation Patwin in the Philippines a couple of years ago. So just versatile, forgiving, and an incredibly capable aeroplane for its time.
The safety record on the Mark 4, how many aircraft have actually been lost?
Well, that's a really good question. Do you know what? I don't think we've lost one in a fight. I don't think so. Anybody correct me on that? Patrick, you'll know that. I don't,
didn't.
I don't think we've lost a single one in a fight somewhere.
Did in the Falklands.
Yes, sorry, one, carrying the SBS that ditched in the Falklands. But not through enemy action. And to give you an idea, he's not here today, but CO of A48 Squadron probably won't mind me relaying a story from him in Afghanistan, where he was underslinging some troops, loads in for the troops up in the mountains, and took, I think it was 7 rounds through the aircraft. And to be quite frank, it would have been easier to list the things that were still working on the that were still working on the aeroplane rather than those that the rounds took out. But it's that good an aeroplane that he was still managed to fly it away, recover it back to an operating base, and then it got repaired and put back into the program, albeit weeks, months later. But to take 7 rounds like that through some pretty complicated systems and still be able to fly it away shows just how good an aeroplane it actually is.
What improvements is Merlin going to bring?
Crikey, there's quite a few. It's a far more modern aeroplane, clearly. It's bigger, more troops in the back. In theory, you can sit 27 troops in the back of a Sea King, but they'd have to be pretty small troops, to be quite frank. And I don't know if it's just that Royal Marines have grown over the years, eaten more Weetabix or what, but you wouldn't fit 27 fully laden Marines in the back of a Sea King anymore. Can't fit that many in a Merlin either, 24, but pretty comfortably with all their kit. So you can carry more. It can undersling more in terms of load lifting. It can go a lot further, and it can go there a lot quicker. Add to that all the avionics systems and upgrades that are in there. It brings it up to a far more modern and up-to-date battlefield helicopter than the Sea King, which is why we're having to replace them. They're now outdated, sadly. So further, faster, and doing more. It'll be a great improvement for our prime customer, 3 Commander Brigade Royal Marines.
But you'll only have half the number.
We will have not half the number, actually, slightly less, but we have what we need to be able to support. Bear in mind that when the Sea King was introduced, the combat effectiveness and size of the Royal Marines was a lot bigger, and what they required to go and do something. UK Defence clearly was a lot bigger. I can't think how many ships we had in the Royal Navy when I joined and the Sea King was introduced, but it's a lot more than we have now. So the scaling down in terms of the number of aeroplanes is commensurate with the task that we've got now to support them at the Royal Marines, and equally with the capacity and so on being that much greater. We don't need as many, actually, to fulfil the task that we would have done with the Sea King anyway.
Do you see the reliability of the Merlin being an advantage in that respect, and there won't be so many aircraft having downtime?
On the record or off the record, remarkably, the Sea King, whilst it's been a pretty reliable aeroplane, over the last few weeks, it's just been absolutely incredible. I think 5 or 6 out of the 7 aircraft on the line every single day waiting to be flown, which is superb. Merlin is a far more complex aeroplane in terms of the avionics and so on. It's also far more complex in terms of the warning systems and management systems of telling you when things are going wrong on it. We're clearly just getting used to it, but the fleet arm's been flying Merlin for 12 years already, so we're learning a lot from our compadres down at Culdrose who've been flying the anti-submarine variant for that decade or so. So for the moment, it's not as reliable as the Sea King has been for the last few weeks, but that will only get better as we get more used to it. We've used some of the engineers who have operated and maintained the grey Merlins down at Cold Rose. We've had those through the transition plan coming into our own Merlin as well. So we're building that experience level up, and sure, it absolutely will be as reliable ultimately as the Sea King, of course it will.
What would you say has been the greatest achievement of the Sea King over its long time in service?
Oh, crikey. I don't think I'd want to pick one out. I think perhaps just the continued success right throughout its career. As I said, the versatility that it's had from the inaugural night flying piece and low lifting in the Falklands, through the support to the IUC and PSNI in Northern Ireland, the peace support under the UN in Bosnia, Iraq, Sierra Leone, Afghanistan. It's just been consistent all the way through, and a really reliable aeroplane for us. And we've, you know, been fortunate to build a really good reputation up as a force in our support of the Marines and the wider army because of the Sea King, because of its reliability and what it's done for us over that time.
And what do you think will be missed most about it?
I don't know, oil leaks, the smell, I don't know. I think any of us that have flown the Sea King would have fallen in love with it. It's been the only aeroplane I've flown out of front line, and I don't think there's any particular thing about the Sea King. It's just the Sea King. It's just such a good aeroplane. We'll all miss it.
Thank you.
Good. The remaining aircraft you have on strength now, what's the highest time airframe? How many hours? Bearing in mind what theatres they've all been in.
I don't know, about 10,000 hours, something like that. What's the airframe hours, Bob? About 10,000? About 10,000, which is pretty high.
Yeah.
I mean, other airplanes in defence will have higher than that. Of course they will. I suspect there'll be a few Chinooks around, by example, that have got the same or not more, if not more. But 10,000 flying hours, that's a lot of time airborne. A lot more than I've got.
All right, thank you. Yeah.
What was Weston's design like?
Again, I don't know. I haven't got a clue. I suspect it's probably a third of that. But, you know, this is, what, 1940s, 50s technology from a Sikorsky variant that here we are in 2016, still flying on operations, in some pretty complex operations to boot. So it's, you know, 60, 70-year-old technology. It's doing well, even though it has got 10,000 hours on the airplanes. Anything else?
How many hours have you got on?
Just over 3,000. So not a huge amount, certainly probably half of what some of my more experienced pilots have got. But that's perks of being sent off to staff jobs and being promoted out of the enjoyable jobs. So, sadly. I flew last week, though, in a mighty Sea King down to Portsmouth and back. And hopefully it won't be the last one. I'm reliant on the senior pilot and CO to make sure I get at least another trip in before she bows out. So, yeah. I mean, it is amazing, actually. I do probably more Merlin flying now than Sea King because of the role and so forth. But the two just don't compare. There is no comparison with the two helicopters. And likewise, you know, we have the Wildcat as well within CHF, and the three are all very different. But the Sea King is like putting an old comfortable pair of gloves on when you get in by comparison with the Merlin. The Merlin, I find, will probably catch me out if I don't have a good instructor next to me to make sure I'm doing the right thing or the wrong thing. Whereas the Sea King, I feel really comfortable in still, and I think everybody would probably feel the same way.
Would you find the Sea King easier to fly than the Merlin in confined areas with its size and engines?
Probably the biggest difference actually is it's a simple tactical detail, but the view you get as a pilot from up front in a Sea King is different to that in a Merlin. And actually with a Merlin, because it's got a nose-up attitude in the hover, and you can't see as much out up front, it just is more difficult in a confined area for the pilot. That said, it's slightly more stable than a Sea King, so therefore it makes it easier in that sense. So there's pros and cons to it. It's just different.
More downdraft.
A lot more downdraft, yeah. Yeah, hell of a lot.
Should we take one more question, sir?
Okay.
Favourite Sea King story?
Oh, crikey. Yes, so many of them. Do you know, I think everybody's got a story to tell about Norway. Anybody who's flown in Norway, we go up there every year and to do some environmental training. It's probably about the harshest environment anybody can go and learn to fly in. Which is why it's such good training for us, not least the fact that we have to operate it in support of the Royal Marines over there. I was number three in a formation of four. And in Norway, because it's that cold, if you get into the really poor visibility because of snowstorms and what have you, you can't go up because it's too cold and it just freezes up with ice and so on. You can't necessarily go backwards because there's somebody behind you. And to either side of us was fairly big wires, so below was the only option. Sure enough, the snowstorm came in, and we were formating on the second aircraft in the formation, and that was the only thing we could see. Could see anything else. You could have been upside down, left, right, anything. the aircraft in front of us slowed down so far and came towards us, so we had to go over the top of it. We landed a couple of minutes later, fortunately, all in one piece. And the aircraft captain from the second aircraft, I saw him climbing up on top of his aircraft to the beanie, which is a bit on top that you can see in the picture there, the little white bit, and checked it. I said, "What are you looking for?" And he said, "Your tyre marks." I think we were quite close, but necessity saw us do what we had to do. Dozens of others. I could go on, but I shan't. Right, I think that's probably up.
Next, we're taken down to the hangar, where there were two Mark IVs. One was being stripped down, and the other was used to give us a safety briefing from one of the spare jungly pilots.
And then first of all, as you approach the aircraft, you want to approach the aircraft between the 10 o'clock and the 2 o'clock position from the front. Main reason being you need to stay away from the tail rotor on the end there, which is the most dangerous part of the aircraft, obviously spinning at such an RPM. But that's the main thing you need to stay away from. So you'll follow the air crewman, he'll lead you out towards the front of the aircraft between the 10 o'clock and 2 o'clock. He'll give the marshaller, he'll be stood on the edge of the disc that's painted on the ground, the thumbs up. He'll get an indication from the pilot that he's happy for you to lead yourselves in, and then just follow the lead of the air crewman, essentially, making sure you stay within this arc between the 10 and 2 position. And we've got the personnel door on the front here, which is the main kind of VIP route in and out, or used initially by the pilots to board the aircraft. And then we've got the cargo door on the starboard side, aft, or halfway down the aircraft. And you'll probably actually enter through the cargo door. Usually once they're up and running, because it's a rotors running crew change, that will remain locked throughout. And you'll enter and exit through the cargo door on the other side. Another point to note, you may get the chance to stand up during the flight and stand actually behind the pilots, have a look out the front. If that's the case, just make sure you don't lean on the personnel door there. It is locked and is secure, but there could be cases where the lock fails, and if you're resting on there, obviously you don't want to, the door to open and fall out the side there.
After the briefing, we were kitted out with protective headgear, briefed on final details of the waiting aircraft, and then escorted down to the two Avengers. I was on Avenger 2, that was Zulu Gulf 821. Now, after being welcomed by the Royal Marine Sergeant and strapped in for takeoff, the doors were opened and we taxied out. We're just strapped in now and we're starting to taxi. We're airborne. It's surprisingly stable and smooth, and although pretty noisy with the doors open, it's extremely exciting seeing the world from this new perspective. We flew north over Somerset and saw Glastonbury and the Tor, and in the late afternoon light it looked spectacular. We were so lucky to have been blessed with clear skies. I sat hooked on by the open door, and although thrilling, I have a lot of respect for the winchmen and aircrew, as I think my days for that sort of excitement are definitely over. I did, however, get a great shot of Avenger 1, slightly in front of us, turning to land back at Yeovilton, and I'll put that in the show notes. So just off the aircraft, what a fantastic experience that was. Got to sit in the open cargo door and look out at the other Sea King as it flew in echelon with us. So what a fantastic experience that was. And what a sad sight to see the good old Sea King, the HC4, the jungly, being retired. Just before we leave this feature, I got a few minutes with David Gibbons, MBE, and Fellow of the Royal Aeronautical Society, a design and flight engineer with Westland. He's highly honoured in the industry for his work, of particular note on the Fairey Rotodyne. Also for the Westland Lynx, where he flew the prototype as the flight test engineer.
I joined the Air Force and RAF apprentice.
Yeah.
And then went navigator. And when I came back from navigator training in Canada, the Canberra had gone from 2 to 1.
Ah, okay.
So they had a massive surplus of navigators, and they'd had so many people go over, they had a massive shortage of engineers. And I didn't want to go back into the RAF as an engineer. So I managed to find my way out of the RAF and join Fairey Aviation.
Okay.
So I then spent 3 glorious years firing guided missiles up and down Cardigan Bay out of Meteors. Then that all packed up and I got moved to the aircraft division.
Yeah.
And I got involved in the Rotodyne.
Okay, and the Fairey Rotodyne. Yeah. Wow, that was an interesting aircraft.
That's right. And because
what was your role there?
I was originally flight engineer, but we were multitasked at, Fairey.
Yeah.
I was down there as a propulsion engineer on the rigs. But because I was air crew anyway, and they wanted a flight engineer for the Rotodyne at the moment, I got into it.
Yeah.
And I did about 30, 50 hours. Then the Rotodyne packed up, and I got moved into flight test because Fairies were doing the Scout and the Wasp.
I think I'm going to get called over there in a minute. Very sorry, David.
That's all right. Anyway, I then became a flight test engineer at Yeovil, and I stayed at Yeovil until 1993, retired as chief flight test engineer.
Wow.
I did the first flight in the Lynx. I saw the Merlin in.
Yeah.
And that's it, really.
And we're here to talk about the retirement of the Sea King. What memories have you got of that?
Oh, lots. The first time I flew in a Sea King was shortly after it came from Liverpool in 1966. So it was 50 years ago since I flew in a Sea King.
Wow.
And I flew in it from time to time all the way through my career.
Yeah. Fond memories of the Sea King?
Oh, great memories of the Sea King.
Favourite memory?
Probably flying in a presidential Sea King.
Ah, right.
Because
yes.
I went out to try and get composite blades onto those.
Wow, that must have been something quite impressive.
Well, it was. It was all at Pax River and dealing with the Americans and Top Gun and Tigers, you know.
Yeah.
But the other one was I took a Sea King down to the south of France.
Yep.
Because we managed to persuade the company that from the south of France we could fly for 3 hours in deep over deep water.
Yeah.
Instead of just 20 minutes out into the Atlantic. And I spent about 3 months at San Rafael.
Wow.
And we lost it. We dropped it in the water halfway through. I wasn't on at the time. I was doing something else because I was managing the trial.
Yeah.
And the pilot, you know, actually got out of the aircraft and stepped onto a boat, didn't even get his feet wet.
Well, it's
I always said pilots were like that.
Yeah. Very lucky. Well, David, thank you very much for talking to us and sharing your story.
Well, you're very welcome.
Now, I'd love to thank Tracy Clemson from the Navy Public Relations team for inviting Extended to report on this event. Tracy, thank you very much. Now, after the break, we talk to Dave Morris about the Fairey Barracuda restoration project.
From across the globe, from the centre of aerospace, and now to you.
The Royal Aeronautical Society has a range of specialist groups, which focus on a specific domain or discipline. They form a vital interface between the society and the world at large, and serve both the interests of enthusiasts and professionals through debate, conferences, lectures and other activities. Learn how you can get involved. Visit www.aerosociety.com.
Event Fire Solutions is an independent fire and rescue service providing both preventative and reactive emergency services across the UK. As well as our main event management, we provide the support and equipment to deliver a safe and risk-free event. From fire appliances to medical vehicles, our fully trained and accredited staff will make your event a true success. If you need risk-related advice, investigation, medical or fire training, then we can deliver this for you. From the office to the airfield, we have the experience and the accreditation and most of all the skills to make your workplace event safe and risk-free. To find out more of how we can help you, look us up at eventfiresolutions.co.uk.
I'm back at the Fleet Air Arm Museum and I'm with Dave Morris again. Couldn't resist coming back, Dave, to talk about a project that's very, very close to my heart. For those who don't know from our listeners, we're going to talk about the Barracuda restoration here. So, Dave, welcome back to Extended.
Hi, Peter.
Now, Dave, one thing we missed when I was last here is the structure of the museum. Just before we talk about the Barracuda, can you just explain to us the affiliation with the Royal Navy?
Yeah, absolutely. Very recently, all of the major naval museum heritage sites, the Portsmouth Naval Dockyard, Royal Naval Museum, the Submarine Museum, the Royal Marines, Explosion, more recently HMS Caroline in Belfast, HMS Trincomalee in Hartlepool, and the Fleet Air Arm Museum here at Yeovilton. We've all now joined, in a sense, as one organisation to become the National Museum of the Royal Navy. So all of the collections individually, of course, stay where they are, but we are all now under the umbrella of the National Museum of the Royal Navy.
To us outsiders, we probably just thought that anyway, but thanks for clarifying that. Now, we're in the restoration workshop, and we're looking at the undeniable front end of a Fairey Barracuda. We talked very briefly about the aircraft and the restoration project a little while ago, but let's come back and talk about what you've got, the airframe, and how we're going to put this together to eventually get the only complete airframe that exists in the world anywhere. What have we got here then, Dave?
Well, the main lump, if you like, the main piece we're looking at here is from Barracuda DP-872. Now, that formed the basis of the whole thought and reasoning behind a Barracuda project way back in the 1970s. Before I was here at the museum, people were collecting material with the aspiration of producing some form of rebuilt, reconstructed Barracuda, albeit using, where possible, crash site remains that have been officially allowed to be collected through the Ministry of Defence, and, of course, making parts where some pieces are missing. That's been an on-off situation for many, many years. When I joined the museum, I was certainly aware of the project, began to be involved with it myself, of course, and now, finally, 30-something years on, I'm actually driving the project. So that's been a really, really interesting path to be associated with and follow. We now have something like four or five other Barracuda crash sites worth of wreckage to assist. The build will always be DP-872 as the baseline aircraft, but we do now have components from other, correctly authorized recoveries from crash sites to help fill in some of the pieces. But the intention is to use as much original material as possible. There are no Barracudas left in the world that we know of, not complete. We have what we believe to be the biggest collection of Barracuda components here. And for that reason, we want to try and use as much of that original material as possible.
Dave, why is it so important then that that we're undertaking this project? What's so important about the Barracuda and its role in the Fleet Air Arm?
Key aircraft from Fleet Air Arm history. And the one thing which you have to say about the Barracuda is the amount that were made. More Barracudas were ordered and built for the British Royal Navy than any other aircraft ordered for the Fleet Air Arm or Royal Navy ever, including up to date. More than 2,500 Barracudas were built for the British Royal Navy. Not an example exists today. And it's such a key part of that World War II development from the Fairey Swordfish into the Fairey Albacore into the Fairey Barracuda, which was the modern monoplane torpedo dive bomber of the day.
And it was the first Fleet Air Arm monoplane dive bomber, wasn't it, I understand?
For torpedo work, yes. Dive bomber, not necessarily the first and only, because there was the Blackburn Skua alongside, but the Blackburn Skua wasn't torpedo equipped. But if you're talking about a dive bomber with torpedo capability, then yes, we're looking at a monoplane first here with the Barracuda. And proved itself undeniably with the Tirpitz raid, albeit they're in bombing role rather than torpedo role. A lot of people forget that, and this is certainly not to take anything away from the very, very brave Lancaster RAF bomber crews that finally sunk the Tirpitz. A lot of people forget or perhaps don't even realize that four waves of Barracudas went in. I think it was something like 42 Barracudas in four waves, 15 direct hits on Tirpitz, and prevented a leaving Alta Fjord. That's what they had to do. They were never going to sink the Tirpitz with the size of bomb that a Barracuda would carry, but the Barracuda did perform incredibly well there and did the job.
So let's come back to this airframe then. It was delivered to the Fleet Air Arm, I think, in July 1943, something like that. It was lost on a ferry flight, wasn't it, from Maydown?
Indeed, flying out of Maydown in Northern Ireland in 1944. Reason for accident unknown. Unfortunately, it was just a catastrophic accident shortly after takeoff, and the aircraft went into Inachloch, just about 2 miles off the end of the airfield, and remained there, submerged into a very difficult to access peat bog lake, and sadly with the crew on board. Difficult with the machinery involved at the time. There was also a lot of other aircraft crashing at the time. Not able to respond, sadly, to get the crew out during the war years. By the 1970s, the families involved obviously wished that the crew members could be correctly recovered and given proper burial. And again, with more time available post-war and with better equipment and better recovery vehicles and cranes available, that was able to be achieved. So the crew were properly and correctly buried nearby in the local church. And the wreckage was always deemed to be allowed to come to the Fleet Air Arm Museum, provided something meaningful as a tribute to all Barracuda crews could take place from the recovery of that wreckage. And that's what we're seeing here today.
Okay, so we're looking at the front end of the aircraft, the engine housing, the air intakes. I can see both what looks like original parts. It's that unusual light blue, and then what looks like some newly fabricated parts. What's the challenge that you've got in bringing the old and new together?
Challenge is the word. A lot of the work you're seeing there was done back in the 1990s. This project has been switched on and off several times over the years, often due to funding. It's not just time. We only have so much time available to us to work on it. But of course, you know, funding can have an impact on that. The grey panel work, the sheet work there, that is actually manufactured from new metal. Those skins, the actual nose of the airplane, the point of impact, they were sadly completely destroyed. There are no remnants of those original skins. So they have been manufactured from drawings and from some reverse engineering from the framework around the engine area. But those were manufactured back in the 1990s using metal, brand new cut metal.
And Dave, do I see an engine block underneath all of that?
You do, and that is the original engine. So that did exist in fairly good complete form. So that formed the basis of the nose reconstruction there. So a lot of the tube work, got some live flying going on behind us here.
It's noisy, but it's good noisy.
Just goes to show we are right on the edge of an active airfield here. That's the new Augusta 101s that are taking over from the Sea Kings coming in there. Back to the Barracuda. A lot of the original engine and the engine bearers and structure were able to be salvaged. It's just the skin work which we've been able to form new around that. But if I turn us this way a little, and we come back to...
We're looking at the front end up to where the pilot sits in the cockpit, probably halfway down the aircraft to a jig that's holding what looks like a frame with some main parts on.
Best way to describe it at the moment, to us, that's frame 11. not that you would necessarily recognise that, but that is the start point from if we're seriously now building a Barracuda and the project is now underway in a sense much better than it's ever been before. It's in-house, we've got the skills, we've got the technology with the workers that are working on it, we've got much better working facility and just tools and hardware, sheet metal working equipment, better than we've ever had before. So we're able to really start looking at where we start. So we've actually researched and understood now that all Barracudas, no matter who made them, Fairey Aviation, Blackburn under license, Westlands, Boltonapaul, they all start at frame 11. So we've created our frame 11 jig here. And this is the first time, we believe, that a Barracuda frame 11 jig has been set in 71 years. So we're quite proud to be able to say that in the hangar here today. And what you see there, the difference between that and a lot of the work we've saw previously where we've used new material, because technology's improved, because our skill level's improved, because we've had more bits of Barracuda wreckage to choose from, 90% of what you're looking at there is totally original reclaimed Barracuda material.
At this point, Dave showed me a compressed air canister which held air from the legs of the Barracuda recovered from the peat bog. The seals had remained intact all of this time, and when taking them apart, the restoration team were able to attach hoses to the seals and save the air. This air was being sent to the forensic team at Bournemouth University.
So the air that's in that bottle, my dad probably would have breathed like his crew members. We've done some cross-referencing, and we know that this airframe was at Thorney Island the same time as that air crew were. We also know that they were at Maydown as well, doing some training. We're doing some more work to see if we can cross-reference and see if there was any connection with this. But are there any other stories linked to the airframe or the other airframes that make this story even better than it was?
Not specifically identifiable at the moment. And you use the word cross-reference there, and that's the key. Pilots and observers' logbooks, the flying logbooks, are so critical to us understanding the history of any of these airplanes, not just the Barracuda, but any airplanes in the collection. We're always very keen to see if any family members have got their uncles, fathers, grandfathers, whatever, flying logbook from a Royal Navy, period of Royal Navy flying. The detail of information in that is critical for us. It'll have the aircraft serial numbers, the dates, the air stations, the reason why they were flying. All of that, as a cross-referencing tool, begins to help us track what perhaps an individual aircraft actually did.
Okay, well, we'll do a bit more work on those logbooks. Dave, what's the next step for this airframe then?
Well, like you say, you were beginning to look from left to right here in the hangar and clearly identifying the nose section, and then moving as we did to the right, looking at frame 11. Our next stage is to actually get frame 11 joined back to the cockpit section in its correct position. At that point, we're beginning to start to define the shape of an airplane. You won't be looking at an interesting but isolated frame over there and a slightly disconnected nose and fuselage there. Bringing the two together is very much the next stage of the game. And at that point, people will begin to realize and start to see what a Barracuda actually looks like.
And what sort of time frame will you see that next stage taking over? I'm wondering when I'm going to come back and see the next bit, the insert.
Well, you're welcome back any time, Peter. You know that. Quite how much it'll look like a Barracuda by your next visit, I don't know. Time is the problem. Some bits of work move forward very quickly. Some bits of work cause us great problems. When you're trying to use as much of the original material as possible, that probably takes 2 to 3 times longer than just making a brand new manufactured part. Trying to straighten out and carefully remanipulate or sort of save a buckled or bent or original part just takes so much time. So it's very, very difficult to put a time scale on it. We've got an overall thought in our minds of stages, what it will look like after 18 months, what it will look like after 3 years, what it will look like after 5 years. They're our own sort of yardsticks here, and they help keep us disciplined on track from that point of view. But it will be very difficult to describe to you here what she will look like in a year's time. But do come back.
I will. And of course, the biggest requirement here is funding. And although this is being done under the cloak of the museum, it takes a lot of money, which isn't there. How can people help you out with that?
Indeed. Funding does move the project forward. There's no two ways about that. And we've got on the museum's website, there's a Just Giving button. If people are interested and want to look on there and see the work we're doing, they can donate there. If they visit the museum, we've got a specific collection spinner. It's a nose cone of an aircraft outside of the door there. So people can look into the restoration workshop, view the restoration work in operation. They can make a direct donation there. And, of course, they can post in if somebody felt that they wanted to contribute. By all means, just write and send your contribution. We'd be delighted.
Well, Dave, I'll go away and study logbooks, and we'll come back and compare notes again very, very soon. Thanks very much for having us again.
Thank you, Peter, and I'm delighted to welcome you anytime.
With all this Fleet Air Arm content, I also got the chance to speak to Matt Willis, Naval Air Historian. Matt, welcome to Extended.
Thanks, Peter. It's good to be back.
Well, Matt, you're a naval air historian, and we recently just heard from Dave Morris at the Fleet Air Arm Museum about the Barracuda restoration project. You're writing a book about the aircraft. What makes the Barracuda so special?
Lots of things, actually. I mean, it's an incredibly important aircraft in the history of the Fleet Air Arm. And in British aviation generally, and I don't think that importance is often acknowledged quite as much as it should be. As I think Dave mentioned, it's actually the largest aircraft by numbers built and serving with the Fleet Air Arm. More so, about 200 more Barracudas than Swordfish, even in actually what was a much shorter production run in terms of time. But also in terms of their achievements, what they meant for the Fleet Air Arm, it was a massively significant aeroplane, but also one of contradictions. That it's an aircraft that so in general aviation circles has a really poor reputation, which actually started. That poor reputation was around before it even joined squadrons, before it had even really gone all that far into production. And yet that really stands out against some of the things that it did in service. And also, it's one of those aircraft that I've spoken to a number of pilots and tags and observers who flew with the aircraft, and some of them actually really loved it, and some of them, you know, couldn't stand it and would be happy if they never saw one again. So it's really an aircraft of huge contradictions, and I just find that fascinating.
Well, we did hear that it was the highest ever produced aircraft for the Fleet Air Arm, but why is it, Matt, that we've heard so little about it?
Well, I think probably a number of reasons. I think one of the main ones being it was developed as a torpedo bomber, or is that being one of its major functions. By the time it appeared in squadron service, the role of the torpedo bomber was a lot less significant than it had been earlier in the war. So the major operations where the Fleet Air Arm used the torpedo as their ship-killing weapon, so Taranto and against the Bismarck in 1941, those were undertaken by the Swordfish, but the big enemy capital ships were out of the picture by the time the Barracuda appeared.
Yeah.
Which obviously the caveat to that is the Tirpitz, which as Dave mentioned, the Barracuda's actually managed to put that out of action for something like 3 months.
But Dave was saying there that they weren't using torpedoes.
No, that was using the 1,600-pound armour-piercing bomb, and it was as a dive bomber that the Barracuda had did most of its work. Really, there is a myth that it never used a torpedo in anger. That's not true. There were actually a number of anti-shipping missions in the North Sea off the coast of Norway that where torpedoes were used and successfully. But yeah, I mean, it was as a dive bomber that the machine was did most of its offensive work, and actually it was an incredibly effective dive bomber, far more so than the American Grumman Avenger, which usually, again, those two aircraft are compared, and the Barracuda's compared unfavorably to it. But the Avenger was really a level bomber. It could do shallow dive bombing, kind of glide bombing, as it's known. But the Barracuda, actually, for steep, accurate, dive bombing in the true sense, was actually very, very good at doing that, and did a lot of damage in that capacity.
Right, okay. Well, Matt, tell us what the variants of the aircraft were. I believe the Mark 1 was the test aircraft, but it had a very, very short production life, didn't it? But they squeezed a couple of versions in.
Yeah, I mean, well, it was the main production took place between 1942 and 1945. The vast majority of the 2,500-odd aircraft were produced in that time, and I'll come back to this actually, because it's the actual mass production of the aircraft is something that's relatively little known, but is a real is a fascinating and very successful operation in my view. But the two main operational versions were the Mark II and the Mark III, and they were mainly differentiated by the type of radar that they carried. The airframe was largely the same. The Mark II used the ASV Mark II radar, which is kind of familiar to people with the sort of television aerial style Yagi aerials on the upper wing. And the Mark III used the radar, which was the ASV Mark 11, I believe. And that was carried in a radome under the rear fuselage.
Right, okay.
And the idea behind these was that the Mark III had the better radar. It had better discrimination. It was better at picking out small targets with better precision. But the Mark II was lighter. The idea behind them was that they would carry out more or less the same roles, but the Mark III could do a bit more. It would be more successful at night, it would be better against submarines. But in the end, the Mark III, the weight of it was too great to carry the torpedo.
Yeah.
It just put it a bit over the weight limit. So that ended up mainly being used in the anti-submarine role, but also it was still possible to dive bomb with the Mark III. So that became more of a sort of general strike aircraft, whereas the Mark II was still intended to carry the torpedo and the large anti-ship bombs. So that's the main difference.
Dad certainly talked a lot more, I think, about the Mark III, and certainly carrying bombs. He didn't ever mention them flying with torpedoes at all, actually. That was quite interesting. The other interesting point there that you mentioned, Matt, was the night flying. He's got a very significant amount of night flying in his logbook as well. So obviously they were up to a lot there. Let's come back to production then. What was unique about that production? The production runs
well. I think the part of the significance of the Barracuda was that it really was the first, very much, it was the first aircraft that was intended for mass production in the fleet air arm, and it was set up. The production of it was set up as a production group along the same lines as the heavy bombers for the RAF. And so the companies that were involved in that were Fairey, Blackburn, Bolton and Paul, Westland a little bit, but they pulled out of it quite early. The design of the Barracuda was done in such a way that it could be built in very complete sub-assemblies and joined up later on the floor of the production shop, the assembly shop. And it's quite actually incredible to see the photographs of this, and there are quite a few at the BAE Systems archive at Brough, photographs of the production of it. And it's astonishing to see these sub-assemblies sitting there almost entirely complete. So the cockpit's complete with all the instruments and the controls plumbed in, but just sitting there a section of cockpit.
Yeah.
The engines, the power egg, as they called it, which was a complete unit with all the plumbing and cowlings and so on attached. And the idea was that you could more or less take a sub-assembly from a different factory and bolt them together and they would fit. And it's quite astonishing to the effort that was put into making sure that everything was precise and everything in each factory was done in the same way. I think it's a testament to the success of the design of that production system that they were able to turn out so many Barracudas. And just to sort of come back to what I said earlier, I think they started the production really in in the sort of late spring of 1942 and carried through sort of almost until the end of the war, and in doing so produced around 2,600 aircraft, and that was done in 2.5 years, say.
Yeah.
When you compare that to the Swordfish, where around 2,300 were built, but they were produced between 1936 and 1944. So although a comparable number were made, they were produced at a much, much slower rate.
I want to come back to the Swordfish later. I've got a question I want to ask you about that. But Dad always worried about the Barracuda. He said the build quality was sometimes suspect. He sadly saw an aircraft that they were flying in formation with fold up, in his words, and crash next to him.
Yeah.
Was this a fair reflection from the crews? Was the build quality bad? Or
well, I think obviously compared to, I mean, these were mass-produced aircraft we were talking about rather than hand-built ones. Yeah. I think in terms of the production quality, there were, and this comes back really to the situation into which the Barracuda was born. It was designed for a different engine. It was designed to be somewhat lighter than it eventually turned out to be. It was delayed for quite a long time because in the early part of the war, the priority for labor, for production materials, for machine tooling and so on, went to RAF aircraft. So when the Barracuda was started up again, it was already over a year late, probably more like 2 years late from where it had intended to be. And really some of the usual problems started to crop up during testing. It was really too late to go back to the production line, and it would have taken too many aircraft out of circulation to try and remedy some of those issues that had cropped up. So I think in some cases it's with an aircraft that hadn't been delayed quite so much to circumstances that were nothing to do with the aircraft, those would have been fixed and it wouldn't have been a problem. I think in terms of the there were some fatal crashes early on in the testing and squadron service, and I think these have been put down to some quirks in the handling that meant that an aircraft could sort of divert from its controlled flight and overstress the airframe, and these were worked out, and people like Eric Winkle Brown were working on these problems, and eventually they sort of realized where the handling issues were coming from, and I think the aircraft was a lot safer once those parameters had been established. There were a few other things I think that related to the weight growth of the aircraft, so the locking pins on the wings, according to some accounts, there were some problems with those, and that was causing the wings to basically fold while the aircraft was in a dive. But again, once that was established, a lot of these crashes were early on in the aircraft's career.
He did particularly mention the locking pins. I don't know where he got that from or where that came from, but that does stand out from the stories he told us.
Yeah, and again, I'm not sure how much of that is
folklore.
How much of that, because it's not something I've come across in the official documentation, whereas there's a lot of work went into the handling. So there were, because of the at the time rather unique flaps that were used
as dive
brakes, and if you look at the photographs of this, that they were quite clever in the way they used, in that they sort of reversed, so the trailing edge went up in a dive, which created drag without lift. But that created a big trim, a big difference in the trim of the aircraft. So what tended to happen was you put the flaps on in order to slow the aircraft down in the dive, and then the trim of it changed. So you had to wind on a good two turns of trim in the dive. And then you pull out of the dive, you launch the torpedo, you're jinking to avoid flak, and somewhere in amongst that, you've got to remember to take the two turns of trim off before you take the flaps off. Otherwise, and it took several seconds for that effect to come in. So you'd take the flaps off, and then probably I think up to 7 seconds later, you'd get this big whack of trim that would come. Yeah, that was a consequence of you having wound it on in the dive. So that was causing people to basically the aircraft would just then, being very low, would just crash into the sea.
It was challenging to fly, though, wasn't it?
In some respects, yes. And I think partly because of the design of it with these flaps that were to help it slow down in the dive, that created other challenges.
It had
challenges.
Some unique handling characteristics, didn't it?
Yeah, I think that would be fair. again, you speak to some pilots, and it was actually nothing. It was regarded as a complication that was almost a sort of part of the job.
Yeah, sure.
So it's not ideal by any stretch, but once you know about it and you can deal with it, then actually that's something you can factor in.
It did have extensive battle honours, you know, Europe, yeah. Mediterranean, Africa, and as far as the Pacific as well. As the European yeah. war waned, they were shipped out to the Pacific as well. Did the Barracuda fail to flatter in its role?
Well, I think actually, no, I think it was actually, I think it could be said to be pretty successful. I don't think there was anything really I think the only problem with it was it having been designed and very much intended for a European Mediterranean war, it didn't have the greatest range compared to the Roman Avenger, for example. So I think they were finding that once they were getting into the Pacific and the sorts of distances that were involved were getting farther, it was better to have something like the Avenger just on account of it having a greater endurance. In terms of raids on the East Indies, it was very successful. There were a lot of raids in the sort of in the sort of spring and summer of 1944 where it was really taking the fight to the Japanese forces in the area in a way that the Fleet Air Arm hadn't been able to in the past. And also in terms of working in concert with the US Navy, that was the first time that had been done. So it really, at the same time as it was doing an awful lot of useful work against the Tirpitz and against German merchant shipping in the North Sea and off the coast of Norway, it was also doing a great deal of damage to Japanese forces and facilities in the Far East.
Well, Matt, I want to find out more about the aircraft. I'm very excited about the book. When can we see it published?
Oh, crikey, that's a difficult one. I actually submitted the manuscript yesterday. So it's very much, I think, now in the hands of in the hands of the publishers and the work that needs to be done from now on as to when it would appear. I hope it will be later this year. That obviously depends on all kinds of other things. I will say now there is some information on my website which might do to tie people over until the book comes. My website is navalairhistory.com, and one of the featured posts is called Barracuda Wreckage and Recollections, and so there are a lot of photographs of the wreckage of DP-872 that's currently being restored, as we heard. Quite a lot of information about the aircraft, but obviously I'm hopeful that the book will be out at some point this year.
Now, no rest for the wicked, as they say. You're working on your next book already, The Blackburn Shark. Now, this isn't an aircraft. If I make a confession, I didn't know anything about this aircraft at all until you told me you were writing a book on it. So it's not well known. Tell us about it. And why write this book?
Well, I think you've already given one good reason, which is that not many people know about it. It really is one of those extremely obscure aircraft, but which I think actually doesn't deserve to be. It was a competitor to the Fairy Swordfish. And it's fair to say that it really sort of lost out to the Swordfish. It arrived in squadron service the year before. It was identical in role, so it was a torpedo bomber and sort of spotting and reconnaissance aircraft. Similar configuration.
It does. It sort of looks bizarrely quite similar to the Swordfish, doesn't it? Big, and heavy, biplane. Big, chunky radial.
It was actually rather more modern than the Swordfish, which is sort of one of the reasons why it's slightly odd that it was retired in favour of the Swordfish. But it had a stress skin all-metal fuselage. The wing cellule is quite interesting because it was sort of Warren girder strut braced. There weren't actually many wires in there. It wasn't like a conventional biplane. It was all done with struts. and the later Marks had had an enclosed cockpit, so it was actually quite a bit more modern than the Swordfish in many respects. But it was in service at the same time that the Fleet Air Arm decided to standardise on the Swordfish. At the time, thinking it was only going to be in service for a couple of years, so it was actually part of the modernisation of the Fleet Air Arm just before the Second World War. It took part in a couple of the big fleet reviews. I think it did a certain amount to help the Fleet Air Arm prepare for war. But actually, where it did most of its work was in the unglamorous second line roles. So it did a lot of work as a target tug, as a trainer, sort of gunnery trainer and observer trainer. And there were several actually licensed built in Canada as float planes, and they actually served patrolling the coastline against U-boats and so on, which again, not something that's that tends to get a lot of publicity, but it's it was very, very useful, worthwhile, but rather unglamorous service.
All right, well, good luck with that. Let's come back to the Swordfish then, probably better known than both the Shark or the Barracuda.
Yes, yeah,
around the world, but recently came under some criticism last year, and it was suggested it wasn't the success it's often made out to be. You wrote a blog post to dispel some of those myths. Tell us a little bit about why that all sort of panned out that way.
Well, there's an interesting theory that started to arise about some of the... because obviously the record of the Swordfish is fairly unimpeachable. Mm. It knocked out a significant portion of the Italian fleet at Taranto. It damaged the Bismarck sufficiently that the pursuing warships could catch up with it and finish it off. But the suggestion was that it was actually because the aircraft was so slow and verging on obsolete that the modern anti-aircraft systems, particularly on the Bismarck, couldn't track the aircraft because it was going slower than they'd been designed to deal with.
Right, okay.
So the anti-aircraft guns couldn't follow the Swordfish as they were attacking, and as a result, they escaped, you know, being knocked down and were able to get in sufficiently to get a couple of hits on the ship and damage the rudder and propellers, and you know, the rest is history.
So is it true, or...?
It has... There is... Right, that's no. Basically, is it true? Largely, no. There are a great deal of circumstances involved in the flights to attack the Bismarck. They were done in appalling weather, which I think is difficult to imagine. Many more modern aircraft wouldn't have been able to fly in that weather. The conditions of visibility were very poor. It very much played to the Swordfish's strengths, in that they could carry out, they could approach out of the range of the anti-aircraft guns and then perform a steep dive to get to the level where they could drop the torpedoes. They were incredibly tractable. They could be thrown about to avoid anti-aircraft gunfire. Now, I understand it is true that the Bismarck's anti-aircraft guns, the medium guns in particular, the directors were designed to track faster aircraft. But I think this is a relatively small factor as to why the Swordfish were successful. I think you could argue that the Swordfish were bordering on obsolete at the time of the attack, but actually the Bismarck's anti-aircraft systems weren't that great. They were a bit outdated themselves. There weren't as many guns as were later felt to be necessary. The directors were poorly sighted and weren't didn't work well together. So there are a lot of reasons why the Swordfish was successful. And I think this argument partly comes from this notion that we still have today. There's still a lot of it around that the Germans were sort of unparalleled technical brilliance, whereas the British, particularly the Fleet Air Arm, was this kind of make do and mend sort of service. And I think a lot of people still have trouble believing that the myth, and I think it really is largely a myth, of German absolute technological supremacy, you know, could fall to an old sticks and wire biplane like the Swordfish. And I think that's a very simplistic view, and I don't think it has a great deal of truth in it. But you do see it out there, this view put that it was almost that they were lucky that they turned up with such an old aircraft. But I don't think there's much truth in it, really. I think the good design qualities of the Swordfish were valid. shall we say.
Well done, Matt.
Thank you.
Well done for putting that case correct. Matt, before we go, I got, of course, to visit 848 Squadron to see the last of the Sea King Mark IV junglies before they retire next month. As a historian, what's your view of their contribution to the Fleet Air Arm and the Commando Helicopter Force?
It's immeasurable, really. I think it's one of those remarkable aircraft, like the Swordfish, that's just gone on and on and on and on longer than anyone thought it could. And it's astonishing when you think that when the Sea King had been in service for around 10 years, the MOD was starting to panic and consider it urgent to replace them. They've gone on for another 30 or so. Their contribution to the commando force has been unbelievable, really. And when the Wessex that they replaced, which in its way was a very effective helicopter, but it wasn't quite big enough. It didn't have the endurance or the load carrying ability, and the Sea King was able to just increase the flexibility and capability of the force by a considerable margin. I think it's just a testament to the qualities of the aircraft that it's been in service for so long. But everything comes to an end, and we'll see how the Merlins do as their replacement.
Well, Matt, on that note, thank you very much for joining us. But before you go, tell us where we can find out again a little bit about your books and where we can find you on social media.
My website is navalairhistory.com, and you should find a reasonably up-to-date list of my publications on that. I'm on Twitter at Naval Air History. Feel free to seek me out and ping me a tweet. That's probably the two main ways to get hold of me in this capacity.
Right, Matt, thank you very much for joining us today.
No, you're welcome. Great to talk.
I thought it'd be interesting to let you know what my dad thought of the Barracuda. Here's a small excerpt from the interview we did with him a few years ago.
And the Barracuda, what was that like to fly in? Was it a nice stable plane or?
It was a death trap. In the Isle of Man, they were doing bombing practice, and a friend of mine who was on the course with me, he was the air gun on it, and the wing folded back and it went straight in. After the war, they made a mention that the strap they were using clipped the wing in and made it safe. They were using inferior metal. So this could have been the case where the metal snapped.
And the wings folded on the Barracuda, so literally it folded in flight.
Yeah, the wing folded and everything. And then, of course, you've got no chance. You go straight in.
And so then you got to go to an operational squadron, which was 822 Squadron?
That's right. And because squadrons have been taken off aircraft carriers, we went to RAF base, what they call ASBU, Anti-Small Battle Units. Well, we didn't mind because you come on more or less RAF discipline rather than Navy discipline, which is always different.
And was the discipline different between the RAF and the Navy?
Completely different. I mean, you try to walk around in the Navy on a carrier or anything like that with your flying boots on, your scarf on, and an Irving jacket on, swaggering around. You wouldn't get far. You'd be on commander's report. But in there, you could.
So 822 Squadron was doing coastal command activities. What sort of things were you doing?
Because they thought that their one- and two-man submarines, they'd heard about it from either the French resistance, that they were trying to build these things. And also, E-boats were hopping around. So they were laying mines, and we had to look out for mines. I managed to have a good few shots at mines. I don't think I ever sunk one, but I had a good go.
You also used to patrol down by the Channel Islands.
That's right, on the obviously it wasn't in our permit to fly over the Channel Islands.
Because they were occupied by the Germans.
So when we used to flip round and get nearer that nice little fort that was on the beach, he used to say to the pilot, by the way, have you noticed them ripples down by the starboard wing? And there was, they used to fire these Oerlikon cannon. And because we were about 100 feet off the sea, you could see the ripples coming up.
So the Germans were firing at you?
Oh, yeah. I later visited the fort where the Harlequin cannons were on. I used to take pot shots of this. And we didn't actually put our fingers up to our nose, but we really shouldn't have done that. Tempt them and everything.
And from your logbook, around this time, you were flying Ansons, Swordfish and Barracudas.
No, just Barracudas.
Just Barracudas.
Our squadron, by the time we got on it, they got rid of the Swordfish and we were on these Barracudas. And it was quite nice going on Thorn Patrol because what we used to do is go in the canteen and there was nice bacon and eggs served up by the Italians who used to be prisoner of wars. And we used to have our bacon and eggs and go on Thorn Patrol.
And so you came to the end of your service, the war ended, and you carried on serving until June 1946?
That's right. I was at Lee and Soane at the time, and they asked me specially whether I wanted to stay in. I wanted to stay in the Fleet Era, but anyway, they put my arms behind my back and come out.
And so some of your memories are fond ones and some not so fond. What do you take from all of that?
Oh, I learned a lot. I learned about camaraderie. I learned about always trying to do your best at the time. And the greatest thing, I think, was I made my father proud. And he was very, very proud. The thing that I always loved the Navy, even now, I go around, I've got my badge on my blazer. And I'm always so proud when somebody asks me.
Well done, Dad.
Thanks very much.
Okay, that's all for this special extra episode on the Fleet Air Arm and the retirement of the Sea King Mark IV. But before we go, we want to say welcome to one of our new listeners, Emma Braden, who recently asked her dad to delete apps and photos from her phone in order to make room for the latest episode of Extended. Now that's what I call committed. That's amazing, Emma, so thank you very much for tuning in again. We hope you continue to enjoy the programme.
Extended. It's time to talk aviation. Email us now. Get involved at aviation-extended.co.uk. And remember, there's no E at the beginning of Extended. Aviation questions, suggested topics, or even good old feedback are all welcome.
We're really keen to encourage more youngsters in the sector, so help share the programme to your friends on Facebook, Twitter, and other social media. If you've got a story or want to get mentioned on the show for an aviation or an aerospace cause, please do let us know. Okay, that's about it. We'd like to thank White Hearts and Peter Dixon for their contributions to the show. You can find Extended on Stitcher.com, UKPodcast.com, PodDirectory.com and of course on iTunes. Our legal policy and use of our material can be found on our website. Please do ask though before using anything you hear. The programme is produced with a Creative Commons licence. Now, if you want a little bit more information on Captain Eric Winkle Brown, there's a lovely personal reflection from Matt Willis on his website. That was obviously scribed shortly after we talked to Matt, so I'll put a link in the show notes to that. That's it then. You can find me, Nascot Hornet, on Twitter and at XTP Media. You can find Tim on Twitter at R-A-E-S, Tim R, and Gareth on Twitter at Gareth_Stringer. With the arrival of the music, it's goodbye from me, Peter Johnson, and remember, stay tuned to this frequency. That is, of course, aerospace radio station Extended.
Extended would like to thank its partners, Global Aviation Resource, the Royal Aeronautical Society and XTP Media for their support in helping to present and produce the programme. Thanks for listening to Extended.
We'll see you next time. And don't forget, we want you to contact us. So get involved at aviation-extended.co.uk is the email address you need.
This is XTP Media.